Hello there, Homer. Welcome to Shakespeare in Context. As always, we're happy that you're here listening. This is a supplemental program of the monthly Second Sunday Shakespeare event, where we examine historical and cultural context surrounding the play that we're about to read this month. The program is co-sponsored by the newly formed Mud Bay Bards, a creative branch of Pier 1 Theater, the Friends of the Homer Library, and the Ketchmack Bay Campus. Today we have Jeff Myers, history professor from KBC, here with us to chat about some Elizabethan goings-on surrounding the Two Gentlemen of Verona, our read this month. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. We also have Doug Kester, the school engagement specialist of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thanks for being here as well, Doug.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. And a shout out to all my Homer brothers and sisters out there. I love you dearly.
And I'm Sarah Brewer, chair of the Mud Bay Bards. Some of the topics that we are going to be talking about today might be a little bit triggering some people, and that's why we have Doug here. And Doug, I didn't know if you wanted to comment about some resources.
Well, we've all experienced trauma in our life in one way or another, and some worse than others. So if you feel yourself being triggered or just like having some real uncomfortable feelings or memories come up, just make sure you take care of yourself in any way that works for you. At the end, we're going to have some resources available locally that you can reach out to. And just know that Homer is a place of safety, and there's many people there that can help you in so many ways.
Great. Thank you. The Two Gentlemen of Verona. Let's start chatting. We've spent a lot of our spring in Italy. We've read Romeo and Juliet. Last month, we read The Merchant of Venice. And now we're heading back to Verona with these two gentlemen. In this play, we've got our two, Proteus and Valentine. These are two buddies, and one of them, Proteus, is in love with Julia. And Valentine, he wants to travel to Milan to seek his fortune. And when he gets there, he falls in love with Silvia, whose father, the Duke of Milan, would rather her marry Thurio. Proteus goes to Milan to visit Valentine, and he also falls in love with Silvia, forgetting his love and declared devotion to Julia. And then he plots against Valentine, his best friend, eventually getting the Duke of Milan to banish him. And he tries over and over to woo Silvia, who is having none of it. Julia, meanwhile, has traveled to Milan dressed as a boy to follow Proteus and bears witness to all of this, eventually becoming a page to deliver the wooings from Proteus to Silvia. Valentine has fled to the woods after his banishment and has become the leader of this band of merry thieves, kind of in the style of Robin Hood. And Silvia runs away to find him, pursued by Proteus, who is pursued by Julia, dressed as Sebastian. She gets apprehended by these thieves, and when Proteus enters to save her, she refuses. And then there's this incredibly uncomfortable scene in which he makes to sexually assault her in his lustful rage of being dejected. At this point, Valentine enters, and Proteus apologizes for everything. And in true Shakespearean comedy, all is forgiven. Julia reveals herself. Proteus magically falls back in love with her, and the four of them plan their marriages, and that's how the show ends. There's also these two lovely characters who serve as servants to the gentlemen, Lance and Speed. And this, just a side note, is the only play of Shakespeare's to feature a dog in the dramatis personae, Lance's dog Crab. This play has kind of been noted as this coming of age story for these two young men, but understandably, there are some problematic elements of the ending, which has contributed to this play being one of the less popular ones and one of the ones that's less frequently produced. It's also considered to be one of Shakespeare's first plays. Perhaps some scholars speculate that it is his very first play, possibly written in Stratford before he ever made his way to London. And I have this image in my head of him, manuscript in hand, as he's making his way to London to try his hand in the theater world. Jeff, I just wanted to know if you could tell us a little bit about what might have been going on with the process of theaters and purpose-built theaters in general, because it was a fairly new thing that had been going on in Elizabethan England.
Yeah, around this time in the 1570s in Elizabethan England especially, actors and plays became more popular. They were roving vagabonds is what the government called them. The reason why they called them vagabonds and the reason why they were roving is because at this time, play acting, stagecraft wasn't seen as something that was above board. It was something tolerated. Someone mentioned it's kind of like usury. You tolerate it, you don't like it, but it's there. And so it won't go away. And so we're not really, no one's really sure exactly what was the first play or when he wrote this. If he was walking from Stratford to London with this play in his hand, he probably would have had to have some kind of pass because of the bubonic plague. And so people who were moving from one place to another, no matter who they were, unless you were royalty, right? You had to have a pass. And people kind of viewed strangers from afar because they didn't want the plague to come into their area. And so I can imagine that when he got there and he saw a stage being built, probably south of London to keep the riffraff away from the actual city, he probably saw something that was bigger than anything he'd seen before. Maybe if it's the original theater that James Burbage built, it was probably kind of Colosseum-esque, made of wood with 3,000 people, very large, could fit in there with a pit where the riffraff could pay to go watch. And then it would have like three different levels of where the non-riffraff would pay a little more to watch the show. And if he would go there and he saw a play, it would be ruckus. There would be drinking. There would be prostitution. There would be fights. There would be booing. There would be throwing of vegetables, all of it. And so that's probably the London stage scene that he came to.
The theater, the name of the theater that Burbage had built, had already been in existence for a while, right? But the profession of acting in within a theater had only come around, I think, in the last decade before he got there. If you wanted to be an actor on the stage, you had to be a part of a group of players that was sponsored by somebody that had money. Greenblatt, I think, has a book called Will and the World. And in that, he's talking about there's some evidence that Shakespeare even like parked carriages. Like he really started at the bottom when he first got to London and really started making his way up. Right from the get-go in this, one of the earliest plays, you can see when you read this play, you can already see the brilliance of his poetry. We have Clara Stating from Homer Flex and also a drama debate forensics competitor with one of Valentine's monologues for Sylvia. Have a listen. This is just after Proteus has betrayed him and has gotten Sylvia's father, the Duke of Milan, to banish him. Here's Clara Stating.
And why not death rather than living torment? To die is to be banished from myself, and Sylvia is myself. Banished from her is self from self, a deadly banishment. What light is light if Sylvia be not seen? What joy is joy if Sylvia be not by? Unless it be to think that she is by and feed upon the shadow of perfection. Except I be by Sylvia in the night, there is no music in the nightingale. Unless I look on Sylvia in the day, there is no day for me to look upon. She is my essence, and I leave to be if I be not by her fair influence fostered, illumined, cherished, kept alive. I fly not death to his deadly doom. Tarry I here, I but attend on death. But fly I hence, I fly away from life.
So Clara and I had this really lovely talk after she recorded this about how Valentine had both elements of Romeo in his love for Rosalind at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, before he meets her. And then he has this touch of Hamlet's melancholy and his ponderings about life and death. And we really get a sense of this youthful idealism of love through these young men that are pining for these women. And again, Valentine's the one with the integrity in this play. So even amidst this new show of brilliance, not all of the contemporary playwrights were very complimentary of Shakespeare. Jeff, what can you tell us about some of these contemporaries that Shakespeare might have met with when he arrived to London?
Probably the most famous was Robert Greene, who was the playwright of Elizabethan England. He was the most famous of all of them at the time as a contemporary.
More famous than Christopher Marlowe?
Yeah, because when Greene died penniless, by the way, because all of the money went to the actors and not the playwrights, he died quite poor. The point that I think you're trying to make is when Shakespeare came, and there's fairly good evidence he was also a pretty good actor, Shakespeare was. And so I think there's a little tinge of jealousy in Greene's, he can act and write plays, was Greene attacked him in 1592 and he called him an upstart crow, beautified with our feathers.
Yeah.
Which essentially he said Shakespeare was plagiarizing. We don't know how Shakespeare reacted to that, but it must have hurt.
We actually have one more recording. Peter Norton, beloved actor here in Homer, is going to give us just a little snippet of that quote of Robert Greene's that he published. So have a listen. This is Peter Norton as Robert Greene chiding Shakespeare.
There is an upstart crow, beautified with our feathers, that with his tiger's heart wrapped in a player's hide, supposes he is well able to bombast out a blank verse as the best of you, and being an absolute Johannes factotum, is in his own conceit the only shake scene in a country.
So this quote references a line from Henry VI, Part 3. That was right after one of Marlowe's epic histories. I think Shakespeare wanted to really try his hand at these epic histories. And he wrote Henry VI, Parts 2, 3, and then 1. The tiger's heart's referring to Queen Margaret in that. And the Johannes factotum translates to like this jack of all trade. Again, since Shakespeare engaged in all aspects of the theater, managerial roles, acting, writing, everything. And apparently people didn't like that. So one of the things that struck me when I was reading this play, as always when I read Shakespeare, just because I love him so much, is that it really mirrors parts of our own society that get illuminated. It resonates so much even now, even 400 years later after he's written it. And so I was really struck by this scene at the end in which Proteus is about to essentially rape Sylvia now that they're in the woods. He views her as this, as being ungrateful for him saving her from these thieves who would have, quote, forced her honor. And for her part, Sylvia is this incredible character that really sticks up for herself and makes her mind known that she doesn't have any interest in anyone but Valentine, because that's who she's in love with. And she finds Proteus pretty odious because she knows that he's left this other young woman in Verona. But at this point in the play, in Act 5, Proteus then turns on her and says now he's going to force her to yield to his desire. And he grabs her. That's a stage direction. He grabs her and kind of makes to assault her. But then Valentine comes in and stops him. And while Proteus, in the line that he apologizes and shows remorse, it's pretty close to holding up this mirror to the rape culture that we still see rampant today in our communities and on college campuses, particularly between acquaintances. You know, Proteus and Sylvia know each other. Doug, this is where I'm going to kind of bring you in. What can you tell us about some of the current numbers dealing with like acquaintance rape in society today, and what some of the stuff that you're doing with the network? What kind of programs are happening in the state to maybe proactively prevent this type of assault in particular?
Thanks for giving me an opportunity to speak to that. You know, in Alaska, sexual violence is higher than anywhere else in the nation. We can all take that in. And it shouldn't be that way, because we all know in Alaska, we all look out for each other as neighbors, as relatives. I really feel like we have a culture that like supports and keeps each other safe. But it's not so much that way in this particular circumstance. First off, I know, and we all know for a fact, that most rapes or any kind of sexual violence goes way underreported. Especially ones, as you called it, acquaintance rape. And most people that do suffer sexual violence do know the perpetrator. It could be, you know, somebody in their life in a zillion different ways, but that makes it way harder to report. So many of them go unreported, but the ones that we do know that are reported, it is an incredibly high number. I think throughout a woman's lifetime in Alaska, in Alaska, it's like 1 out of 3 women have sexual violence in some way perpetrated upon them.
Something else that struck me when I was reading this play is Proteus gets a super quick pass. Everything reconciles really fast. Julia says, "I don't mind, I still love you," and they get married, which is not okay by any stretch of the imagination. But it really made me think about, I think about like college campuses. I think about, you know, the Brock Turner that was, you know, out there in Stanford that we read about just in the last couple of years. And a lot of these instances of campus rape and these young men that are or late teens, early 20s, right? And a lot of them are really committing these egregious errors in judgment. The question that kept popping up in my head was, what type of work is being done in the state to, again, prevent that, you know, in the schools to say, hey, this is something that might come up when you go to college, you know, and when it happens preventatively, what are some of the types of programs that you see maybe with the network? And then after it happens with the perpetrators, this was the question that kept popping in my head. Proteus is reconciled, you know, he does show remorse and he is forgiven. So with young men that perpetrate this violence onto victims in college, what is there for them too? How do we treat them in such a way that they can turn this massive lack of judgment that caused trauma to another person so that they can be a part of the solution and a part of this change for good, having been a perpetrator?
There's like 3 questions in there. So I'm going to take just the first 2 just really shortly. Yes, we have all sorts of programs to actually teach in the schools to like help people learn how to, one, have a healthy relationship and healthy communication and learn how to use assertive communication to say exactly what you want. And it's really important to talk about consent. What is consent? How do people, consent to sexual activity? How does that all work? Actually, in Alaska, we are reforming our consent laws right now as we speak. So yes, that is all happening in the schools. I really wanted to tie some of this in with Shakespeare because that hit me all of a sudden how cool that it's something that we are doing at the network and around the state as prevention workers is the same thing that Shakespeare was doing in his day. And that is really challenging some of the gender norms of the day. And gender norms are something that are constructed by society to say men are this way and females are this way. These days, we're really starting to understand some of the unhealthy aspects of those gender norms. And that is something that I work on in the schools to try to help explain why certain gender norms lead to more sexual violence or more violence in any way, from domestic violence to whatever. And those gender norms are really ones that Shakespeare talks about. He's putting a mirror in our face oftentimes to be like, he's just showing us that that's what some of these norms are. And the norms I'm talking about, especially the ones that have to do with masculinity, are that, you know, men and boys have a very small window of emotion that they're allowed to express. They are supposed to, you know, not be emotional and not make decisions, you know, based on emotions. Other norms are that they're supposed to be highly sexualized and like really want sex. Men are supposed to be the ones in power and control. And in those times, I would love to hear what Jeff has to say about this. Yeah. It seems similar to what is happening today. Is that true, Jeff?
Those are all great points, Doug, and you're absolutely correct. Elizabethan culture had the fairly similar norms to, say, like the Rome Republic into the Roman Empire. They taught Ovid in class a lot, not to get too academic, but he's one of the first writers who taught men how to seduce women. And here's what it is like to be manly. And so Ovid changed throughout his life. But the point being is a lot of what Shakespeare's writing about as far as the culture of Elizabethan gender norms goes all the way back to Aristotle and Ovid, which is there's men and men have roles And then there's not quite formed men who are females, and they have roles too, and they're not the same. Ovid writes a lot about going after the conquest. You may call it force. That force is pleasing to the females. And so I think Proteus mm-hmm. is that man. And then
used Ovid's Metamorphosis as his source material for a lot of his plays throughout the canon.
Yeah, so Proteus is that man. And then Valentin is kind of what Sarah was talking about. He's the friend who comes in and says, whoa, you can't do that. And of course, in Shakespeare, everyone says, okay, yeah, he was wrong. But there is that arrival of the friend who basically argues, it's not 2020, so it's 1590. He basically argues that this will ruin our friendship, right? Not necessarily the moral aspect of what he's about to do, but he says, we're friends and we're male friends, and maybe that's more important than anything else. And so Shakespeare goes about it that way in the final scene. But he also, if you were to see the play and how he wrote it, he also wrote it to make the audience feel bad for Sylvia because she's kind of silent. What Doug is talking about is absolutely correct. He kind of flips it. Mm-hmm. He says, yeah, this is a manly man, and this is kind of how he was stopped. But then he makes Sylvia make the audience feel like the uncomfortableness of what happened.
And that was another point that I thought of when I saw this scene, was the power that male friends have to hold each other accountable well before it ever gets to a situation like assault. It happens with locker room talk and objectification of women. Doug, I didn't know if you could again talk about some of the work that you're doing with that.
Oh, you're so right. Well, that is another aspect of my work, is engaging men and boys. Because as we know, if women could have solved this issue of violence against them, whether it's sexual or domestic violence or whatever, it would have been solved a long time ago. It's the men who are doing the majority of this violence. So it really, the solution has to be found with them. One of the things that we've been doing is engaging men in this matter. And it's not about telling men that they can't beat or can't, you know, have sexual violence and do that. No, it's about connecting. There's way more opportunity for men to connect with each other. And when you have a connection with other men or a group of men, you tend to hold yourself more accountable as a man, because you feel that what you do also reflects on this group of men. And it's so interesting you said that, Jeff, that kind of like a friendship thing, like we won't be friends. It is so that, like, he was holding them accountable, and not in the same language, but I think it's really similar that he is saying, you know, as your brother, as another man, if you do this, you are going to lose status, not only in my eyes, but in society. And as men, if we could hold each other to that higher state of accountability, of respect towards women and towards each other, we can really go a long ways in hopefully solving some of these issues.
Lastly, I'm just going to kind of circle around to the question that I had a little bit earlier. We know that Proteus got really lucky because he did have a friend that came in and said, don't do this. And the act wasn't carried out. I'm really curious, as far as once it's happened, are there any programs out there to help empower the victim, for sure, but not just the victim, but the perpetrator, so that they, like, how long do we vilify them? And then I think about more restorative justice principles and how to affect more change. It seems like if we could even take the ones that didn't have a friend that said it, that grew up with those masculine prototypical mindsets, and that ended up having one of these decisions that was creating trauma for other people, having been a perpetrator. Do you know of anything like that here in Alaska?
Well, you are touching on one of the main issues of what, as a prevention team in Alaska, all of us together are really trying to figure out, in so many other places that work, you know, with protecting women. I wish I could say there was, like, yes, we have this awesome program, but it is really just starting to be developed. Restoring honor for men is a really, really big thing. And shame, I mean, right now the choices in our system is, like, the man goes to prison, comes out, Has he really learned anything? Right. And does he still carry that shame within him? So how can we do this? So I work really closely with an amazing elder, Doug Modig. And when he talks about this, he often talks about, like, you really have to start with the human being, because our in essence, we're all human beings. And it's a beautiful way the native cultures in Alaska have kind of created this idea of, like, first you learn how to be a human being. And what does that mean? How do you be a human being that is, one, there for your community, there to, you know, make sure that you are acting in your utmost integrity, right? No, we don't have any, like, programs. That is one of the essential ingredients, I feel like, of finding healing. There's a lot of healing that needs to happen for men in Alaska. Yeah. It's hard to live in community, which is what we need, and connection, and not harm each other. I mean, yes, there's different levels of that harm, but it happens. So how can we be accountable to ourselves and to each other? And accountability doesn't have to be this super scary thing that, like, we have to, like, okay, this is the moment. It could be just a beautiful natural thing of looking, reflecting on your inside, and, like, this is how I felt, and I see I made you felt like that, and apologizing sincerely, and then not only apologizing, but then what can I do to make this better? What can I do to make this situation, you know, one where you find healing and hopefully I find healing? And I think we can do that as human beings, and men have the capacity to have that courage to go in and do it, but it's not the type of courage we often think of as, you know, with masculinity. Courage is making yourself vulnerable. You're making yourself vulnerable to find that connection and that healing that is going to, like, keep people safe.
Hey guys, thanks so much for spending a bit of your afternoon with me. I was so excited when I read this play and started prepping for the read that's coming. The read is on Mother's Day for all the listeners, May 9th, 1 p.m. And you can find the Zoom link on the Pier 1 Theater website. And it'll also be on the Mud Bay Bard social media platform, as well as on the Friends of the Homer Library website. But I really appreciate you coming in, because some of these issues that I felt coming up when I was reading this play, I'm just thankful for everybody. Thankful that you guys are here doing the work that you do. I'm thankful that, again, Shakespeare in his lifetime wanted to challenge these norms and challenge people's thinking back then in a way that is so timeless that maybe he wasn't doing it in the same exact context, but that we can still do that here. And I just, it's wonderful for me to find these issues that resonate within our society today, reading a text that's over 400 years old. And that's just the ultimate beauty of Shakespeare and why I just am a big fangirl of him. While listening to this, if anybody has been triggered or any feelings are coming up, or if you or anyone you know has been the victim of sexual assault, there are resources available at the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault at www.andvsa.org. And there are also local advocates and a local crisis line here in Homer for those in need at the Haven House right here in Homer. And that number is 235-8943.
We're just asking men to show up. You don't have to know what to do. You can also reach out to Haven House, because there's a great prevention team there that would love to have any men who wants to get involved.
Jeff, history professor at KBC, and Doug Kester from the network here. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
Shakespeare in Context and the Second Sunday Shakespeare is brought to you by the Mud Bay Bards, the new creative branch of Pier 1 Theater, focusing on the works of Shakespeare, the Friends of the Homer Library, and the Kachemak Bay Campus. Pier 1 Theater is made possible in part by grants from the City of Homer, the Alaska State Council on the Arts, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Rasmussen Foundation, the Homer Foundation, and by contributions from community members like you. Take care, guys.